Okay, bring the Environment Natural Resources Policy Committee to order. I apologize for being late. I apologize, Representative Rukavina. We are in another meeting that I had to attend, and we finally got that done, and constituents caught me in the hall, so I apologize. Representative Otto, have you reviewed the minutes? Representative Otto moves the minutes from, Thursday, February 12th. All those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Okay, members, we're going to try to get some bills done here today. We've got Representative Rukavina, Representative Howes, Olson, and Dill that are going to have bills before us today. We're going to try to take care of Representative Rukavina's issue, and then we're going to hear from some folks that we didn't have a chance to hear from the other day on some ISTS issues. So, with that, members, Representative Rukavina, the chair, will move House File 1836. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for... And you don't have to apologize for me. I'm in the minority, so I have nothing to do but walk the halls and cause trouble. So at least you've disciplined me enough to come and do something constructive here today. So it's a simple bill, as you can tell. Changes the wording from taconite to minerals for in-pit mine dumping of either taconite tailings or potentially in the future other non-ferrous tailings. That's the crux of the bill. This language was put into law, I think, in 1994 that I did it. Inland Steel has taken advantage of it, and by doing so, they probably saved about 800 acres up in their area from having a tailings dump, and have just put it into the old pit as they moved on to new pits. I don't believe that there's any opposition from the PCA or the DNR. They're both in the audience, and I appreciate your support.
Okay, very good. Do we have anybody else that would like to testify for or against the bill? Any questions from the committee members? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Rukavina, we are hearing rumblings about asbestos from mining up in that area. Is there any... asbestos question we should be asking you?
Representative Wagenius, there isn't, in the east end of the range, there supposedly is an asbestos-like fiber. I don't know exactly what it's called, but the DNR is here. This has nothing to do with it. The inland steel tailings does not contain that. They've been monitored. There is no, from what I understand, and it's a PCA is here. There's no leaching of any type that anyone deems dangerous. The DNR tests has tested at the inland site. The makeup and geology of the non-ferrous minerals, if it ever happens, would be of a different nature, and I'm sure that the PCA would monitor that. My understanding is by doing this and the fact that it would be have a water covering would stop any type of leaching of that, those types of tailings. But I'm not a geologist, so I...
I'm not a geologist either, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gaines, I will never do anything to hurt my constituents and put them in danger of any types of fibers that would be dangerous to them.
Representative Gaines.
That's good to hear, Representative Rukavina, because I was looking at a map and discovered something I didn't know, in that your area of the state has huge amounts of surface water, but hardly any drinking water. And so when Representative Dill asked lots of questions about conserving groundwater because it's a rare thing up there, he's right on track.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll drink out of almost any lake in my area, if you'll drink out of any lake in your area.
Unfortunately, Representative Rukavina, we're downstream from St. Cloud and from your area, so if we were upstream, it would have been fine.
Madam Chair, downstream. Our water flows towards Canada and towards the Niagara Falls. So,
any other questions? Okay, the chair will renew his motion that House File 1836 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed and sent to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Rukavina. Okay. We're going to have a couple of septic issues that are going to be bills before us today. And before that, we will have Minnesota Environmental Partnership, John Tuma, and Gretchen Sable from the MPCA, and Dave Wirens from the Association of Minnesota Counties come forward. Give us a little presentation that they missed out on the other day. So, welcome to the committee. I'm not sure who wants to go first. Ms. Tuma?
Chairman, members, pleasure to be here again.
Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
My name is John Tuma. I represent the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, a coalition of over 80 environmental conservation organizations in the state of Minnesota. My job before you today, as we talk about the 10-year plan for the septics, folks, is to tell you why we are here talking about a 10-year plan. It really is about Minnesota values. When our organizations got together and decided what our agenda would be over the next few years, it was about protecting our water, and water is a Minnesota value. We recreate it. We occasionally drink it out of the Boundary Waters. I still do dip in and drink my water out of the Boundary Waters, and I'm in the middle of the lake, nowhere near beavers. It is about fishing and swimming in it. Water is what makes Minnesota special, is what makes Minnesota great. And because that's a great value, it doesn't take a genius to recognize that dumping raw sewage into our surface waters and into our streams is not a good idea. And as we looked at this problem with some of our organizations, particularly the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, looked at this issue, and we determined that about one-third of our 536,000 septic systems are not up to standard. And we also estimated that about 64,000 of those systems are either direct discharge or imminent health threats. And note the word I used there. I know environmentalists are accused of sometimes using funny numbers or coming up with statistics that are made up. Well, I'm telling you, that is made up. It is an estimate. Those numbers are estimates based on information that we receive from counties. And that is the problem. They are estimates. We don't know. Even though we have a very solid regulatory system out there, our statutes are good on what must be done when we find imminent health threats, we weren't finding them, and they weren't going out and getting them. You have a map in your packet, a series of three maps in your packet. The first map you'll see talks about whether the lakes are fully supporting or not supporting their intended use, whether it's swimming, fishing, recreating. Not so much to worry about the actual dots in the map, but look at the pie chart below, and this will give you what of our concerns are. It only shows that of our lakes, only about 14 of them have actually been assessed to whether they are there is an impairment, and I think that's important to note. The second map shows you the impaired waterways in the state of Minnesota, and I think the key there again is the pie chart at the bottom. It shows us that only about 5%, I believe, of our waterways have actually been assessed for impairments. The third map that you'll see, and one I want you to pay a little closer attention to, it overlays some of those impaired streams, the red ones being fecal coliform. Okay, that's waste, either animal or human waste, that is contaminating those waters. That is, if you compare that to the second map, you'll see that very few of them have been tested. You will see each county, and under each county is a number. And essentially that number is the estimate from the county officials as to how many of imminent health threat systems they have in their county. Again, these are estimates. For example, Rice County has 900. It's an estimate from the field staff. They don't really actually know there's 900. They're only estimating. Some counties you'll see have, like Hubbard, 100. Well, they're estimating. We don't know. Maybe Rice County is a little more aggressive, wants to do something. Some counties are less. So there is the problem. We don't really know. And what Minnesota Environmental Partnership and our member organizations tried to do last session was come up with solutions on how do we start really nailing down how many of these systems are polluting into our waters. Of those waters that we tested, a significant number of them were determined to be fecally coliform impaired. Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and the Cannon River Watershed Partnership worked extensively on the Strait River. If you look down and you see Rice County and Steele County, the Strait River flows through Owatonna into Faribault, and it was determined that was fecally coliform impaired. They made the assumption that that was animal agriculture when they went down there and they started looking at what was the problem, and they found out that a significant part of the problem wasn't animal agriculture, it was failing septic systems that directly discharging into drain tile lines and right into the rivers. And to the point they thought that 70% of the flow during low flow was coming out of household facilities, coming out of your houses. So the flow that was running through the river was essentially septic discharge. So it wasn't a good place to go swimming and playing. And of course, when I found that out, that was our favorite place with my kids to go throw rocks, is down at the end of the Strait River at the River Bend Nature Center. So it kind of gave me pause as we were throwing those rocks that was essentially septic discharge that we were throwing rocks into. So what we did last year was throw out some ideas about how do we find these failing systems. Do we do things when people sell their houses? Do we require disclosures like we do well disclosures? Do we require townships and cities and counties that are doing their ordinances to actually go out and survey their systems? And as we started throwing ideas out, we met with quite a bit of resistance over some of these ideas. And through the wisdom of the chair and several members, Kathy Tinglestad being the author of the bill, we came up with the idea of sitting down with counties and township officials and city officials and with the PCA and devising a 10-year plan. Why 10 years? It was a round number, so it sounded good. So 10 years is nothing magic. It just seemed like this should be time to do it. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that raw sewage going into our waters is not a good idea and that we should set goals for finding these systems and cleaning them up. In your package should also be an editorial from the Pioneer Press, basically saying, and we call it now, our new theme is the Nike theme. I think we'll go hand out little Nike buttons now. It's just do it. There's no reason we should have this happening in Minnesota when we value our waters. And so we met together. We worked several hours on developing what we think is an excellent 10-year plan. And with that, I hand it off to Gretchen Sabo, who will tell you about our work product.
Thank you, John. I'm Gretchen Sabo. I'm with the Pollution Control Agency, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the past few months, I've been working with a number of other parties and interests in the septic area to try to come up with this 10-year plan. And what we've come up with is a possible way that we can approach this. I think it'd be a fair way to say it. We can. I'd like to back up a little bit. The current law that's now in place was passed fairly recently, in 1994, and then amended in 1997. And so the septic system program has been fairly young. The way that it works is that the state, our agency, the Pollution Control Agency, writes the code, the ISTS code, that regulates how the systems are to be built, and we license the people that do the work, kind of like the plumbing code regulates plumbers through a licensing program. So that's our avenue. We do not regulate individual systems. So it's been kind of a program that's built on the back of local government. And so that's why Dave's up here to talk a little bit about that. As we worked on developing the 10-year plan then, we realized that those local governments, because the counties have county boards of health that deal with the health issues, and because they have land use controls, are the appropriate places to be aiming this program and to doing some more additional work on it. You all should have copies of the report. It's the one with the septic tank swinging into place against the bright blue sky. It's hard to find poetic pictures of septic systems, but I thought they did a good job with that one. So you should all have that. That was passed out on Tuesday. The report looks at a number of different areas. Oh, I should say, too, those current laws that are now in effect, if we do the numbers, if we look at how many systems there are out there and how many are being upgraded, it would take about 25 years with the current triggers that we have in place to fix them all. And 25 years is a generation. That's probably too long to wait. And so that's why the Just Do It theme works for us, too. The elements of the plan that we want to look at are, we have an executive summary in the front. The plan also has a lot of background on what is a septic system, kind of the regulatory framework for septic systems, how we design them, what happens when they don't work right. So there's a lot of stuff you can learn reading this. We tried to make it as informative as possible. And when you get to page 13, that's where the actual plan starts. So if you want to follow along, you can. I won't go into much detail. The first element would be to identify the unsewered properties. Right now, local governments pretty much know who they are, but we want to have them create an inventory of who's out there that isn't connected to a city sewer. That would be the main universe, then, of people we need to regulate. The next part, improving professional competency, is something that we're already working on now at the Pollution Control Agency. Last session, a law was passed that put a $25 fee on all newly installed septic systems. That has allowed us to really beef up our program quite a bit. We have additional staff now who will be doing technical assistance and compliance enforcement work in our regional offices. And they're out there, they're in place now, and they're beginning to do that work. We're going to be doing some work. Some of the bills that are coming up here today are new technology things. Our code was so out of date, we didn't have a way to do new technology. And so these individual vendors and people that want to have better ways to treat sewage didn't have a way to come in. So part of that fee will be used to support our efforts to make our rule be more flexible so we don't have to keep coming back to you guys in future years to have us fix things that we should be fixing ourselves. That's some of the things that we're doing now. We've heard from the Contractors Association. I work with MSCA a lot, the Sewage Treatment Contractors Association, and others, that we didn't have strong enough standards for licensure, that people, you know, in their mid-90s, we had to get people in that were illiterate. There's a lot of people out there doing work in the sewer field that weren't at the standards that you would hope for in a licensed trade, but we had to set the bar low enough to get them in, and now it's time to raise that bar and really kind of improve our technical standards. Those are some things that we're doing now. The rest of the 10-year plan looks at the county programs, beefing up what we ask the counties to do. We would ask the counties to, follow the rules. Dave's giving me an eyeball here. We haven't been able to support counties much in their county programs. We've been offering them $986 for a number of years.
Give or take a dollar.
Yeah, and we just increased that to $1,500 thanks to the tank fee. That is not enough to run a county ISTS program, and we recognize that. And so we've always been somewhat hands-off in terms of enforcement with counties, not asking a lot of them. Our goal would be to change that. And part of what these new staff is going to be doing is working with counties now at the current funding level, and then we'll work with you guys to try to find additional money to make these county programs stronger. We would ask the counties to develop a system to make sure that all the septic systems are maintained. Those of you that live in the metro area and have septic systems realize that in the metro area, Met Council has worked with the cities a lot to have programs that require maintenance. That doesn't happen outside the metro area. We would look in this plan to the counties to do that role outside the metro area. Again, inventory all the ones, but not just know who has sewage treatment and who doesn't, but know what the status of their septic system is. So we'd have to actually have a system of inspections to identify all the straight pipe systems, to identify all the ones that don't meet the standards for sewage treatment and put them on a list to be fixed. So that would be another activity for the county. And then the remainder of the report is kind of a list of options for different ways to do that. We could look at different upgrade triggers. We could look at different inventory maintenance kinds of options. So we lay those out there. And we had really built the plan to be as flexible as the counties needed it to be, because right now there's a variety of practice out there among the counties. If you turn to page 19 and then we'll roll on to 22. We were supposed to also look at funding options. We were able to identify costs. What we've suggested is that we would propose to fund county programs at about $5 per septic system, so a county that had 1,000 septic systems would get $5,000 a year to help administer the program. Counties with a lot more would get a lot more. That, I think, would be kind of a fair way to help with the administrative costs. Counties also fund their programs through fees and other kinds of general funds, and so it's not the only funding stream, but it would help. And then we'd also propose to help homeowners fund their systems. The average cost of an upgrade is probably around $4,000 to $6,000 in Minnesota. That's a lot of money if you don't have much money. It's also in line with putting new siding on your house, new windows, new roofs, some of those other kinds of home repairs that we realize are necessary to keep our homes in good shape. And so rather than saying that the state should fund all of that, we're recommending a funding level of about 5%. And so the figure that you see there on page 22 of about $2 million a year, that we believe would go a long way over 10 years to helping people do the upgrades that they need and to get that work done. The funding source that we had identified was through the impaired waters fee that you had heard about on Tuesday. And if that moves forward, then we would hope that some of that money could come to this as well. And with that, I'll turn it over to David.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President of the Committee, I'm Dave Wyrens with the Association of Minnesota Counties. As part of this program, I'll try and not duplicate some of the comments, because certainly many things that Gretchen had stated are things that I think are very important to keep in mind. Is when it comes to primary delivery of the ISCS program, it's done through counties.
Yeah.
There also are cities and townships that have a role in this, but by and large, the counties are the focal point of making this program work out there on a statewide basis. And while I think it is fair to state that there's a significant upgrade in the current program in the mid-1990s, and the fact that counties required ordinances that comply with the rules in 1999, it's important to keep in mind, too, is that every county is familiar with the program going back into the 1970s. There were requirements through DNR shoreland rules to apply the PCA ISCS standards in shoreland areas going back to the early 70s. So it's not a new program, certainly, but the required scope of responsibility has grown dramatically throughout the course of the 90s, and now we've got, and now we're 5 years into what is a statewide mandated program. The Association of Counties have been an active participant in this development and supporting the improvement in the ISTS program. And I think, as we'll talk about, I think the key shortcoming has been one of resources, and we'll talk more about that later on in my comments. But I think the point behind the 10-year plan is to identify means which we can get on top of this situation in the state of Minnesota and stay there up into the future. And there were a number of conversations that Gretchen, as the primary drafter of the plan, had with counties to get some feedback, not from folks like myself, who will certainly have some background in the program, but the folks out in the field who really know what's going on and give her much more detailed information of the circumstances that are out there. And I think in terms of our reaction to the 10-year plan and counties, you know, we have a broad responsibility for environmental protection in the state of Minnesota. I think as you look at the ISTS program and water planning and what the Conservation Act, you know, when it comes to delivering environmental services in the state of Minnesota, it's not the state any longer. It's doing most of the work. It's at the county level. And the primary concern that counties have had over time has been one of resources. Quite honestly, you know, the old line of that applies here is you get what you pay for. As a matter of state policy, the determination has been is to not provide adequate resources at the local level, and therefore, where you have counties that have more robust programs, the county boards have made the determination that they will find the resources to do what they need to do to take care of those problems. And quite honestly, the counties that have a lot of water, a lot of lakes, like the Crow Wings, the Cass counties of the world, they have made a higher priority because of the importance water is to their citizens, to their local area. In other parts of the state, you look at southwest southwest part of the state, and if you look at the county annual report that's in here, and if you look at the percentages of inland threats to public health, it's primarily in those ag counties. Well, they have less water. It's not as big of a priority because we're talking about farms that are typically widely spread out. And I think they look at what's important. And the state does make it important to provide the financing for this program. It becomes less of a priority at the local level. And you know, I think that's a fact of life, is that how we set incentives does make a difference out there. But be more specific into the 10-year plan, The Association of Minnesota Counties, we do have concerns about this report. It certainly is my experience in talking to a lot of commissioners, a lot of county staff out there, that if the resources and support are available, that more counties will jump on board in a voluntary manner. We get every county to step up and do more? Probably not. But a vast majority of counties will choose to do more if they have a more realistic opportunity. And I think when I talk about that, we also are concerned about the PCA and their staff capacity. We were supportive of the tank fee last year because we knew a large share of those funds would go to increase the PCA staff complement, which was at about 2.5 FTEs, which is now at about, what, 6? So, I mean, they 2.5 full-time equivalents does not have to run a statewide program that's responsible for over 600,000 septic systems in the state of Minnesota in terms of running a program, and we're very concerned about that. Before I talk about some other details, the other thing that's of concern is the 10 years. It was very clear the PCA drafted this plan that 10-year criteria really constrained the policy recommendations that they can make to address this problem. I know I'm talking to a lot of county staff out there. There's not the capacity amongst the industry to take care of all the problems within a 10-year time frame. And obviously the issue there is that by establishing an arbitrary deadline, you're establishing some parts of the state are just going to fail because it doesn't matter what the government capacity is. The designers and installers are not enough out there to get the job done. I talked to a number of counties that have ongoing waiting lists. If you're going up in Stearns County and want to install a system this summer, well, you're probably too late already. You couldn't get the job done because unless we're in Edmonton Public Health, they might find a way to make it a priority. But if you're building a new property, if you're replacing an existing system, you'd be in a very difficult time in finding a contractor because they're booked up throughout the summer. And I think that's a very realistic issue that counties face out there. The suggestions that AMC would make to further the ISDS program is that in the first case is if this is a priority for the state, the first thing you gotta do is help fund what you're currently requiring counties to do. Right now we're having very minimal programs in many counties because it's funded through fees, it's funded through some minimal support from the property tax. And while we appreciate the effort the PCA has made, they've had limited ability to provide more money to counties as well, the resources that they have. But to increase the acceptance, first, pay counties what you're asking for them to do. This is a classic unfunded mandate that's facing here, and I think that needs to be recognized. And then the second piece that does go along the lines of what is in this 10-year plan is to create an incentive-based program. You make resources available to counties to support their efforts to go out and find and work with homeowners on correcting problems, and also make money available that low-income folks can get some assistance in, and you'll find a lot of counties jump on board and will take care of the problems that they know exist within the counties. You know, as Mr. Tuma mentioned, I mean the numbers in the report that are in the appendix of the 10-year plan, they are only estimates because with few exceptions, counties have not had the time or the resources to do a township-by-township, city-by-city inventory of who is on a septic system and does their system actually comply with the rules or not. Because it is a process of going on every property, doing soil borings, examining the systems, to identify the status of those systems. That does require time and money, and the resources are not there to do that. So, Mr. Chair, that is our reaction to this particular problem. And as we have worked in the past to move this program forward, we will be there in the future to keep moving this issue forward in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Wyrens and maybe Ms. Sable can answer this question. You made a comment about the new fee we put on septic tanks and a comment with the new employees that were hired. And wasn't that to start a pilot project in a particular area?
Mr. Chair, there was actually two amounts of money that came to us last year. One was the new tank fee, and the other was the ability to use, we had a small grant program that we'd been giving to Crossroad communities here and there to upgrade their septic systems. We were allowed to use that grant more flexibly. So we used that grant then to fuel the county pilot programs. There'll be three of those that are getting kicked off the meeting. Well, the commission will be deciding in the next few days which counties get chosen. There was 10 counties applied. They all had very good applications, and it's been interesting reviewing them, a number of different ways to approach the issue. Each county will get $60,000 a year for 4 years. So that's almost $250,000 to address the issue. And their goal would be for each of those counties to eliminate all their straight pipe septic systems within, by 2008. Yeah. By 2008. So that's going on too. The other things that we were able to do with the tank fee money, we did hire the new people in our regional offices. They hired me. And there's other work that's going on to update the program, like I said.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I sat on that selection committee, and they were very good plans. Their idea there was to look at creative ways counties could locate these systems, kind of help develop kind of best practices as we move forward with providing counties more resources to identify systems. We thought it'd be a good idea to get at least three counties out there testing a way to do it. So they do have some creative ways of accomplishing it. So I think we'll be pleased with the selections that the commissioner makes. We've forwarded some recommendations out to her. Have some good ideas out there, and it'll set a good direction for counties. The counties are taking care of this. They are the people on the ground working on this issue, and they do care about their water. It was refreshing to see that. It's from a broad range of counties. It wasn't just Lake District counties that applied. It is from some agricultural areas. So I think we'd be pleased to see the applications and the grants that are working.
Okay. We've got some bills that we have to get done, and there's a number of representatives that have questions. First is Representative Wagenius, then Cox, Swenson, and Pennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have essentially two questions. Ms. Sable, on page 5, you reiterated something that we've heard again and again, that non-point sources contribute to 86% of our pollution problem. These are small point sources. They're not non-point. We'll find them in their points. The question I have is, what portion do these point sources, these failing septic systems, contribute to the problem?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, it differs by area. In some areas where, like the Lake Region that Dave was talking about, where the counties have had strong programs for a long time because of shoreland, we believe it's a very small component. In the farm country, where tile lines were the way that we handled waste for many years, the problem is much bigger. It depends by watershed. John talked some about the Straight River, and they get data from the Straight River.
However, here you've given us an overall number. I mean, you could give us a breakdown number if you'd like, but I'm just looking for the overall number since you've given us an overall number.
I don't have that graphic with us. It was the same data that we had used last year, if you recall, when we were discussing this.
I think it would be
based on that.
Important for us to have that is so we could see the proportion that this problem is. And so
Mr.
I would
Chairman,
appreciate that.
Wagenius, I will provide that to you.
Thank you. The second thing is, in here, you discussed maybe tangentially the overlap between wastewater treatment systems provided by cities and counties and townships and individual septic systems. And I'm trying to understand, is there a bright line here? In other words, we look at all of the proposals that counties and cities, et cetera, have made for wastewater treatment systems, and it's a huge outstanding, $1.5 billion, I think. It's a huge. Is this totally separate, or is there a fair amount of overlap here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, we talk about wastewater as more of a continuum than a bright line. And what happens is we have my system, John's system, you know, we have individual septic systems, we have big city plants, and those are clearly both ends. But as you get toward the middle, there is overlap. And so some of the cluster systems that we see coming forward, we have the crossroad communities I talked about, small towns, where instead of putting in a sewage treatment plant, they'll put in a large septic system. And in those kinds of instances, or even they'll sewer around a lake to a number of large septic systems. And in those cases where there's public ownership, then those are indeed eligible for public money. I don't think that we were able to quantify the overlap. I'm looking to Jeff Freeman, and we were not able to quantify the overlap on that, but there will be some overlap.
So in other words, if we funded, capital funded, some of these smaller wastewater treatment systems, we would take care of a portion of this problem, but we just don't know what portion it is.
That's correct, Representative Wagenius. And we also, we need to have some way to address some of the issues that we frequently hear are older people that live on farms that don't want to leave yet and those kinds of issues. They just don't have the capacity. And so we've always said that there needs to be some public money available for low-income people and people in rural areas where those cities won't touch them.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up? I mean, I am very sympathetic with the counties that I mean, PCA has had for 30 years the responsibility to protect groundwater, and yet we're kind of shifting the burden to the counties to take over the functions without providing them any money. It seems to me that what was missing to me in this 10-year plan was the bundle of carrots that we normally give to counties if we're asking them, or to individuals. And I was disappointed not to find that bundle of carrots in here that would be problem solving. There's a little enforcement and a little identifying, but I know I put in a bill to allow people to take the cost off their assessments or their property taxes, just as a carrot. It's a small carrot. Wouldn't solve a big problem. But there are a lot of little carrots we could do. One little carrot, it seems to me, that would be helpful is to have a separate bonding proposal for tiny little systems, as long as there were some government oversight, where you're taking 3 or 4 or 10. But we need a whole bundle of carrots, and they're not in here. And it's really disturbing to me.
Okay, members, we've got to move on. We've got a number of folks that have questions. Representative Cox, Swenson, Pennison, Tingelstad. Are there something that we need to talk about right here? Can you have these folks come to your office, or do you need it in this public forum? Or can we move on to the bill? Okay.
I'm fine.
Okay.
I just had a short question.
Okay, Representative Swenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Sable, you quoted the cost, estimated cost of $4,000 to $6,000, and I guess everything I'm hearing, like in my area, is a lot of umbrella systems. I'm hearing $8,000, $10,000, $12,000. So, I mean, as the cost of these things. So I just, yeah. Isn't that correct? I mean,
Mr. Chair and Representative Swenson, yes, cost does vary widely. You know, there's other systems that are going in for $2,000 and $3,000, and so the statewide average would be $4,000 to $6,000. In the metro area, it's higher, too, where there's more pressure to more competition for these dollars.
Okay, Representative Swenson, did you have anything else?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. We could spend a lot of time on this issue. We could spend the whole committee meeting just talking about septic systems. But we've got other business we have to take care of today. Thank you very much. Representative Howells. Representative Howells, do you want to move your bill, and would you like to take care of the amendment to get it in the shape that you like first?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chairman. Well, first I'd like to move House File 2161 and that it be recommended to pass or sent to the General Register with recommendation. Mr. Chairman, it's an oral amendment on page 2, line 14. Delete the underlined language and retain the stricken language.
Mr. Helen, do you have that amendment?
Yes, I do.
Okay. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Howells, want to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We've had this a bill similar to this before this committee in the year 2002. And you, things are being handed out to you. The infiltrator system is the product that is under the warranty system is 6 feet long. The folks at Infiltrator have designed one that's 4 feet long, and they're able to use it in a better fashion. They're able to use it in something like this that you will, either has already been handed out to you or will be. And when I was approached by them that we needed to have legislation to include the 4 foot section under the warranty product, I said, well, aren't 3 times 4 of these units 12 feet and 2 times 6 of them 12 feet? Why are we doing this? But evidently we are doing it for some particular reason. So with that, I would yield to Mr. Pedersen here Petter Larson, sorry, to explain one small portion of the bill that is, I think, just language and needs to make it flow better.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollis. My name is Peter Larson. I'm here representing Infiltrator Systems, Inc., and Representative Hollis just asked me to describe the language that starts on page 125 and 26. When you passed this language a couple years ago, there were several systems that were already warrantied. The warrantied status was repealed. This language put it back in, and the agency, the PCA, wanted us to do a list of things to make sure that our systems were worthy of this warrantied status. As you can see, the past language had a 1, a 2, a 3, and a 4, and we had to do all of those. This language now allows under B for either past warrantied systems to continue to be warrantied if they modify their systems, or for new systems to come in if they can show that 50 of their systems have been installed. So 1 and 2, we used to have to do both of them because we were required to both be warrantied and have 50 systems in place. The language now allows you either to come in if you were previously warrantied or if you have a new technology and you can show the agency you have 50 in place. So we needed to change the 3 and 4 to be a 1 and 2. So you either do 1 and 2 now and you do the old 3 and 4. So that's why that language is there.
Representative Powell's,
we'll stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. What's the repealer in here? What's that do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when this was passed, you can see on the back of your version, it's 1R. It's got 115.55 subdivision 10. The agency wanted to make sure at the time that they didn't have to review any new technologies because this had to do with their budgets prior to the new money they got to do this. So they wanted to make sure that even though old warrantied systems could retain their warrantied status, they specifically weren't required to review any new technologies. So that's essentially what that repealer is. Because they are going to be in this business, so they wanted to get that out.
The department's in support of the bill, as far as you know. Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. Gretchen Sable again. We've been working with them on this bill. Like I said, we had a number of areas where our rules out of date, and we need to have a way to let new people in, and this has been the way that has worked for this vendor and others to come in through this door, and so we're willing to say that this is fine again. Is there an additional question?
Yeah. Any questions from the members? Anyone else that would like to speak for or against the bill? With that, Representative Howells will renew his motion that House File 2161 pass as amended and be placed on the General Register. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed and sent to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
As amended. Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Olson, do you want to take your amendment first, or do you want to explain the bill first? Or?
Yes. It's a technical amendment. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2040 be recommended to pass and referred to Environment Finance Committee.
Very
and then
good.
To that, I'm sorry, I don't have the number of the amendment, Mr. Chair, but I'd
A1
like to move
amendment.
That amendment. The A1 amendment?
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to move that amendment to put it in the order I need. It's a technical amendment.
Very good. Representative Olson moves the amendment to his bill, the A1 amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Olson, you want to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I would like to present the bill, and then I have a series of people to testify.
Okay.
We'll take questions as we go along with each group to testify, if we could. The House File 2040, members, is a bill to establish a pilot program for approving alternative septic system technology, specifically in the area of separation technology. The bill begins, it's a separate provision in law. We're not amending any current law, and therefore we have to begin with definitions, and I'm going to be somewhat specific because of the uniqueness of this. And if I start to run short on time, Mr. Chair, I'll expect you to push me.
Well, Representative Olson, we got about 20 minutes for you, so.
That's what we figured on. Thank you. Begins biodigestible water reclamation systems are defined as residential wastewater treatment system that separates gray water from black water and treated for safe consumptive use or above or below ground discharge. Black water is defined as sewage from a toilet, urinals, or garbage grinders. Gray water is just the opposite, and anything that does not contain those. System requirements involves that all black water must be treated as black water and not discharged for reuse. Wastewater may only be treated as gray water when it's separated, gray water from black water. Gray water reuse within the facility, the effluent quality from the system must be within the health risk limits according to Minnesota rules. Now, these are current limits, and I'm just, I used a few trees today, I'm begging your pardon, but I'm doing this because I want you to see that while this bill is short, relatively speaking, it involves a lot of current law and rule. So it's Chapter 4717, and we must meet those existing standards. Rainwater discharge outside the residence above ground, the effluent quality there must meet or exceed, again, this time the MPCA rules for water quality rules. Now, one provision later on in the bill, you'll see that we're exempting these systems from the plumbing code. Page 2, line 4, or line 21, toilets in these systems that do not contain standard integral water traps must have a water seal mechanical valve. And that's to address the one concern that has continually come up in getting these, when we try to get these approved at the local level and as well as at the state level. Down to subdivision 1 on page 2, manufacturer certification. It's to be approved by the agency, and the manufacturer has to submit a third-party certification, accredited documentation of these systems being able to meet the criteria that I've just mentioned. The manufacturer must also get training approved by the department, by the agency, excuse me, so that people can be certified to properly install, maintain, operate, and monitor the systems. A manufacturer shall reimburse up to $4,000 for staff services needed for this certification process and these requests. And the agency is also to work with the health department with those funds in reimbursing the health department for any related costs there. The requirements for the manufacturer or consumer participation involves that only trained and certified people may install, operate, repair, maintain, and monitor a biodigester and water reclamation system. The systems must be monitored by an entity other than the owner. So the only one entity that cannot monitor the system is the owner. Annual monitoring and maintenance reports must be submitted to the commissioners of the health and PCA agency, as well as the local regulatory authority. Approval requirements, the permitting is also subject to local government requirements, which are also subject to the commissioner. Any subsurface discharge of treatment effluent must meet MPCA rules for septic systems. Any surface discharge of treated effluent from a system must also meet the same MPCA septic standards and be operated under a permit issued by the agency. The agency can issue either a general permit or an individual permit, and this is a cost-saving measure to be used at the discretion of the agency. Any reuse of treated effluent from a system must be in accord with state standards established for potable water. So in essence, this bill is to allow for, number one, separation of technology, to get that approved, but to cover a range of systems that could involve full recycling and reuse of the water or subsurface discharge. And then that would involve systems that no longer need septic tanks and just simply drain fields. And the last provision is the exemption I mentioned from the current plumbing code. I've contacted local units of government and have not heard any concerns to this at this time, unless they come to the table now. Two points I want to leave you before I turn it over to Gretchen Sable from PCA is that there's been a lot of work on this over the years, as you will hear about in a minute, and one of the entities that have come forward expressing interest in providing monitoring services is the rural electric co-ops. They're already going to each home, and what it really helps us see is a vision for how comprehensive this kind of system, the expansion of services this kind of system could provide and make available to people, the ability to truly protect the environment, getting closer to absolute zero discharge. And current designers and maintenance professionals have shown a lot of interest in basically getting trained in this and providing services in this area as well. With that, Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to turn it over to Gretchen Sable, who's been really good to work with on this. We've struggled for some time to get something together to be workable, and I think and hope we finally have it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We first started working with Representative Olson on this bill. It was still summertime. It was warm out. And we in the health department met with him a number of times talking about some of the concepts here. And we're very comfortable with the bill as it is, and so is the health department. All of our concerns have been met with the language that he's crafted here. I'd like to say a little bit about the technology here. This is something that back when I said in 94, 95, the first laws passed with septic systems. And as you heard, we have a lot of problems with compliance and people not able to meet minimum standards. This technology is way beyond minimum standards. It's so far treats the waters that you're able to actually consume it. It's a full treatment like NASA uses on a spaceship, not like we do just for normal everyday kind of use. And so it was never a real good fit in the rules. And this has been another area where we've struggled with them over the years to come up with a way. And I think that doing this in a separate statute now sets them apart in a way that would allow this kind of a technology to come forward in a new model. And so we really like this kind of an idea, and we're very pleased to have been able to work with Representative Olson on it. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on Subdivision 2, Representative Olson. Under there, you say that only trained and certified persons to install and operate and so forth. Who is that? Are these state-licensed people, or are they certified by the company, or
certified? Mr. Chair, Representative Cox, could you please direct me to the exact provision you're referring to? I didn't hear you correctly.
Oh, excuse me. It's on page 3, line 14, subdivision 2 there. line 15 that reads, only trained and certified persons may install and so forth. And okay. The question I have is, certified by who? Are these state licensed people or is it manufacturer certified?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cox, very good question. That's referring to the certification that's mentioned in the bill that gets approved by the agency. So there's a process. I'll show it to you. Okay, look on page 2, line 27. It begins there, mm-hmm. where there's a certification process for the systems. Now, down to line 35, there's a certification process for the training, mm-hmm. and it's that training that would establish this certification for the people referenced on line 15, page 3.
Representative Cox.
Okay, so these people that the manufacturer are certifying and training, they're actually going to go out in the field and install them because it says install and operate. So it's the same.
Yes.
Okay, thank
you. Mr. Chair, Representative Cox, it'd be training involved, training that would address the issue of installation, operation, repair, maintenance, and then monitoring is set apart by an exclusion that the owner cannot be a part of that. You could have people that are qualified to install, operate, repair, and maintain and monitor all in one.
Mm-hmm.
But the homeowner could not be the part, do the part of monitoring. That's the kind of the big picture.
Thank you.
And you could also have, Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Cox, you could also have someone trained just to operate and repair, maintain, but not install.
Mm-hmm.
It's likely it'll be a package.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Olson, I'm just curious. This is a neat, innovative thing. Where would it be a situation? I would imagine the individual characteristics of the house and their soils and all that would affect it. Where under today's system would the conditions be right for a system like this to be used?
Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, you're going to hear more about that in a minute.
Okay.
And I think I'll leave it for that. In fact, if I could, Mr. Chair, if we could refrain from any more questions, because a lot of them I think will be answered.
Sure.
Plus, that'll give members more time to really look through the bill. But some of our testimony is going to cover that directly, if that's acceptable.
Okay, let's move on.
With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to call up Don Brower, a professional engineer, also served on the board of Freshwater Society for 18 years and multiple other things, but for time's sake, I'll refrain from that with all due respect, and also call up Mark Hayes, who's a designer one from the Wright County area, for testimony. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Donald Brower. I'm a consulting engineer that works for one of the companies that produces these biodigesters, that is Aquarius. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I have been active as a consultant, and also I'm serving as the executive director of the Freshwater Society, and you all probably know that the Freshwater Society does not testify. However, the last time I was before this committee, Representative Unger was the chair, and we testified on the Wetland Preservation Act, but that's been quite a few years ago. My business has been consulting in environmental affairs. I am a registered engineer, and I have concentrated really on water problems since I was asked to work with the Freshwater Society 18 years ago. I've served two terms as the executive director of it, but mostly because I've been trying to find things, trends, and so forth, and I'm only going to point out four of them that I think you should take into consideration that support this direction entirely. The first is, engineers invented waste treatment 150 years ago, and they came up with the marvelous idea that the solution to pollution is dilution. All we've discovered in the last 100 years is we're not able to dilute it enough, because we're now down to parts per billion and trillion, and I don't know how much farther we can go. There's a limit to what technology can do with what we have created in the waste mixed system, which this bill addresses and which this technology addresses by separating waste into two classifications. The second thing I would point out is that distributive energy and distributive utilities are the future, because of sustainability, and that's about the only thing that's going to help us. We're obviously going to have fuel cells, and we're going to have individual ones. We already have major power users that have combined systems that combine heat and energy generation, and this is another technology that will help that distributive technology. Energy is going to be a key in the future. It is already, and we understand that distributive systems will help us have more reliability and more sustainability. And the third factor that I would bring up is health. I think 20 years ago, the Freshwater Society published a Health and Environment Digest. It was the first of its kind in the country. Since that time, I'm sure many of you get copies of Health and Environment Digests or Health and Environment publications relating how we are, as public health and as individual health, related to the environment and environmental influences. Again, this is a technology which can separate and really take care of things that we are not able to and probably never going to be able to take care of, like pharmaceuticals and synthetic chemicals in our waste treatment plants. So with that, I'll turn it over to my cohort.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mark Hayes with Minnesota Environmental Services. I am a licensed ISTS Designer 1, license number 5013, for anyone who wants to look it up. As a company, we design a lot of septic systems. We do a lot of certifications. And to answer the gentleman's question of where would these be most useful, it would without a doubt be around lakeshores. Many lakeshore properties have the same boundaries they did in the 1920s, that being a 40-foot wide lot, which is usually, unfortunately, under 100 feet long, and of which you have an 800-square-foot house, 10-foot setbacks, 50 feet from the lake or 100 feet from the lake, depending on the lake. And quite frankly, you cannot get anything but a holding tank in there. And I have even been to sites where you can't even do that. And my favorite story, and I told Representative Olson I was going to try and find the picture, and I couldn't, but we have ran into situations where some of these lake cabins have had holding tanks, and they got sick and tired of pumping, and they went to Fleet Farmer Menards, got themselves a little 110 pump, a garden hose in the tank, right into the lake. Of course, we turn these over to local units of government every time we stumble across it, but that is one of the problems we face with things like the old technologies. As for biodigesters, they're used almost everywhere on the planet. China uses them for methane generation, and what comes out of them is a high concentrated fertilizer for the rice paddies. The pathogens are eliminated due to heat, and these, like I said, these systems are used in China, Oceania, Germany, the Netherlands, many places across the planet. I'm open for questions if anybody has any site-related or installation questions. Yes, ma'am? Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, Representative Gaines.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can understand part of the digestion system, but here's where I'm stumbling, and I just don't understand it. You've put in here these must meet the following requirements, and one of them is the health risk limits. Unfortunately, our health risk limits are pretty outdated right now, and they don't have in them something like arsenic. So what would a biodigester do with something like arsenic?
Literally leave it alone. It cannot, I mean, arsenic is an atom. A microorganism cannot crack an atom. And I don't mean to be flippant about it, but you would technically need an atom smasher to get rid of it, or some sort of a filter process to get rid of that, unless the engineer, my esteemed colleague, has some other answer.
Okay. Representative, we'll
can I follow up?
Okay.
So these would be suitable then for places where there is not arsenic in the water, that the well water that somebody's using, but may not be suitable for an area where there's a high level of arsenic in the well.
Mr. Brown?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Virginius, the part of the system that is the gray water is the water that would be recycled and reused. If there's a high arsenic level in the local water, then you'd have to buy some water somewhere else or treat it before it got into this system, and this system would then maintain it. In other words, maintain the absence of it. In the bioreactor, that which gets into the bioreactor, yes, would stay there, but it would go be disposed of with that material, which is a fertilizer. And this bioreactor that the company I represent is doesn't make methane because it's aerobic, it's not anaerobic, but it would stay with the fertilizer, in effect, that comes out of it every several years.
if I may.
Mr. Haynes?
Standard ISTS systems do not address things that come up the well. I mean, if it doesn't fall out in the septic tank, or even if it does fall out in the septic tank, for that matter, it gets pumped and land applied, or pumped and take to a municipal plant. If it winds up in the water stream as a dissolved mineral, as arsenic can be, it would wind up in your leaching field, you know, your drain field, your mound, what have you. So the standard systems do not address that either. And as a designer, one, I don't know of any technology for a standard system, you know, a component you could put on there that would address that.
Representative Guinea.
Thank you. I mean, I'm looking for when you're putting this, like, back into a lake, I would want to be thinking about areas where there's a lot of arsenic. And in western Minnesota, there's a lot of arsenic in some of the private wells. The other question I had has to do with hormone disruptors. What does a digester do with a hormone disruptor when you, say, get some in your water, in your gray water?
Mr. Brower?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Virginius, that hormones and those kind of things are attackable by viruses and yeasts and all kinds of things, which one of the advantages of the bioreactor is the material from the waste that's got that in it, and that's where all the pharmaceuticals, or 80% of them, end up, is in the waste stream. The advantage of the bioreactor is that it has a long period of time for bacteria to work on those things. And for the most part, it would be converted to something that's benign.
I mean, that's good news. The question is, are there some standards or involved here that you could say we get rid of 90% of it? I mean, is there some science here that we can see?
Mr. Chair, Representative Virginius, we have not been able to do that as yet. That kind of research on the municipal sewage treatment plants is going on, downstream testing of fish and so forth, to see how synthetic chemicals and estrogens and all of those kind of things, pharmaceuticals of all kind, in our Freshwater Society laboratories. Cargill Incorporated is working on genomics, genetic whatever, and looking into that kind of stuff. I imagine a lot of people are. But as such, I don't know of any written report that I've been able to see that says exactly how that works. In a bioreactor, it would stay there until such time as it was treated. In a sewage treatment plant, there's a certain time that it takes to go through there, and it either gets treated in that amount of time or it doesn't. Right now, pharmaceuticals and synthetic chemicals mostly don't get treated. They go right through.
Looking out for your fish, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Lindgren, did you have a question to these folks?
Fine.
Okay. Representative Dill?
No, I'll hold it on.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Olson, do you have any other testifiers? We want to move on here. We've got one more bill to do after yours.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Two more from Olmsted County, Terry Lee, who's the Environmental Services Coordinator, and Tom Ekdahl, who also works with the county. He's a resident and, I believe, watches over the Chester County Park there. Some of you have been down to see the system that was installed there in 1993, and they're going to tell a little bit of the history of that system and their experiences with it. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Terry Lee, Olmsted County. And my experience with these wastewater separation technologies began in 1993 when we installed one at the park as a demonstration of technologies that we thought could best address some of the concerns we had with our very sensitive karst terrain and some of the small lot subdivisions in and around Rochester. And we monitored that system in the late 1990s and found that it, in fact, did meet our initial expectations and our goals. And that was, we saw a 90% reduction in the nitrogen discharges, and we saw a 1,000-fold reduction in the coliform bacteria that was discharged from the system. So we thought the system was a very effective system. And, in fact, the testing person in our laboratory went so far as to install a system herself. So I thought that was probably a pretty good indication of the quality of treatment. But I was here to answer questions that you may specifically have, and with me today is Tom Ekdahl, who's the park manager and also the person that is living in the house where we installed that demonstration system.
Welcome to the committee. Thanks. Please state your name for the tape.
Tom Ekdahl, again, Olmsted County employee, park manager, and my family and I, we moved into the residence back in 1998, former park manager, retired, and one of the first questions I recall being asked of me as a potential candidate, are you willing to live in a house with worms? And the answer to that question was yes, we would be willing to. My children found it exciting to have a unique system in their home. Since then, we've had some of you folks have been down, you've been through our house. We open it up for folks to come visit to look at this alternative source of taking care of human waste. And as a tenant of a county home, I found, you know, our life goes on normal. Because we have a unique system, we don't do anything out of a normal routine. Our water is separated, and the compost, the black water is separated, just as they've mentioned. There's questions we want to answer.
Any questions from the members? Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have to be careful to with products like Clorox or bleaches so they don't kill your things that are digesting?
Actually, the Clorox is separated through the gray water, which we use it in the laundry, and no, we don't have to not use it. So.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the time on this, and I hope Representative McNamara, your questions were answered as well. Just some closing comments, Mr. Chair. As you heard from the engineer Don Brower, solution to pollution was dilution, and found out that we can't dilute it enough. And the approach that this is really taking is separation, and which immediately, with the system here, reduces water consumption by at least 40%. And the strategy then basically represents using these advanced technologies that didn't exist when that first strategy was initiated. And that involves, with the gray water, taking and starting with aeration, then ozone, then filtration, then ultraviolet light treatment, and then reverse osmosis for a zero discharge system. And then you've just heard about the composting side, the digester side, with the basically the solids from the toilet and more difficult material to get rid of, the waste to get rid of, goes into a composting tank with red worm culture. And that ends up in your garden or on the neighbor's field. But with that, Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate members' support and appreciate your indulgence with time.
One more question. Representative Dill.
Well, I just had a, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. I just had a, I am the chairman of our wastewater treatment community up in our area on the Lake Country, and Mr. Representative McNamara talked about where it would be applicable. We're spending literally millions of dollars in my sewer district barging, installing holding tanks and barging the sewage over to the mainland, and then going out and land applying it. And this is just a unique opportunity for all along the north shore of Lake Superior, on the homes that are located on islands. And one thing that I find interesting about it is you could charge this, the system that I'm most familiar with, it's in this technology group, this is being charged by rainwater from your roof. We don't even need a well anymore. So you don't need to drill a well. There's tens in our area, as what Representative Virginius already mentioned, we have almost no drinking water where we can get at it by well. My well at home is over 400 feet deep and very, very poor in quality, and we don't, you know, it would be wonderful. You could actually begin the first charge of the system like this with Perrier water and then go from there. It's just a kind of an amazing thing, actually. I had a little trouble getting my arms around it originally and kind of grasping the concept, But boy, what an opportunity! I'm really thrilled with it, especially how it's so applicable for in those most sensitive areas with very little soils to work with, poor groundwater. Real opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Dill. Representative Osmond.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I'll be very brief, but I first of all want to compliment Representative Olson on his tenacity on this issue. He's worked on it a long time. This is not new technology in the fact that these facilities have been around for a long time, but members ought to also know that one of the underlying pressures that's been in opposition to this is our zoning and planning activities, and many times those zoning and planning laws or regulations are based upon how we handle the sewage or the waste from that particular structure. And once that is now able to be taken care of within the structure, that starts to put some of that those regulations on their ear. And so it has been very controversial. Been a lot of resistance from individuals. I remember on tour down in Rochester where that very point was brought up, that was where we were getting most of our resistance, or a significant amount of the resistance from. So really appreciate this. I think it's the right thing to do.
Very good. Yes, and I'd like to compliment Representative Olson, too, for the great testimony you brought forward. You did a very, very good job. I've been encouraging you to move this along, too. It's a great idea. Hopefully you can get it done.
Thank you, members.
With that, I would like to... We heard the bill that Representative Howells presented earlier that was House File 2161. Folks, I'd like to amend that bill. It's a very technical bill. It takes care of a little bit of a problem. The department's on board. I'd like to add that to Representative Olson's bill, if you don't mind, at this time. So I'd like to make a motion that we put House File 2161, as amended, onto Representative Olson's bill, House File 2040. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. With that, Representative Olson moves that House File 2040 pass as amended and be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is moved to the Environment Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Very good job. Okay, Representative Dill. Representative Dill moves House File 1712 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. Is that correct, Representative Dill?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Chairman Hackbarth.
Thank you.
Members, in 1996, President Clinton passed the Welfare Reform Act, commonly known as the Deadbeat Dad Law. And I don't think anybody here thinks it's a bad idea that we chase down deadbeat dads and make them fulfill their obligations. One of the provisions in that act was that on many categories of licenses the states issue, the Social Security number be collected as a part of the licensing process. That included all recreational licenses. Actually, the law, the 96 provision, federal provision, states that all persons receiving all of these different type of licenses, including recreational licenses, supply their Social Security number. Well, that includes 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old kids. And I feel that it's just a crime. It's wrong. It's just simply wrong that we make kids provide Social Security numbers that wouldn't even be deadbeat dads. Hell, most of them don't even know how to make a kid at that age. At least I hope they
don't. You don't know about that, no, dear.
Well,
they don't all live in Green Lake.
I think you get my drift. Nonetheless, I think that this is something that we can pass out of here. I have to tell you that this is a very expensive bill. I think the fiscal note on this is about $700 million in a biennium. That would mean that we're going up against the federal government and saying we're taking those Social Security numbers off of those licenses for young people. It's a huge amount of money that we would risk. And so with that in mind, we have compromised, and when it gets to Health and Human Services, Senator Bach and I are going to, we already have the amendment drafted. We've talked to Josh and Chairman about it. And we're going to add, we're going to actually make this a thing where the state requests an exemption from the federal government for 12, 13, 14, and 15-year-old kids on these recreational licenses. And that's not how the bill reads. It's before you right now. So I'd like to pass it out of here. We'll amend it over in Health and Human Services. And that way we compromise to a fallback on this because at 16 you've got to have a Social Security number for your driver's license. Most kids have got some kind of a job where they had to fill out a W-9. And so we're willing to live with that. But I think it's just wrong. This got done last year as a part of that mandate process in the Health and Human Services bill, which was passed on, you know, in the omnibus fashion. And I don't really have much more to say than it's just simply wrong. We should be introducing kids to, I saw my friend Ron Chera last night at the Mahoa dinner, and, you know, to coin his phrase, we should be introducing kids to the great outdoors and the coin mine, not to the world of bureaucracy. And so that's my sales pitch. Let's pass it on to the next one and go home.
Sounds good. Questions? Anyone to speak for or against the bill? Okay, Representative Dill renews his motion that House File 1712 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Re-referred to Health and Human Services.
Senator Representative Ramstead was out in the hall a few minutes ago with Senator Bach, and he indicated that when this language gets over to Washington, if we actually pass this into law, he is intending to pass introduce legislation that would cure the problem. Not just the option of an exemption issued, but actually legislation to cure the problem. So this is we're doing our part.
Thank you very much. Okay. Okay, members, do we have anything else? I'm not sure what are we doing on Tuesday. Some more bills or? Okay. Yeah, we might have a few bills on Tuesday. We're not real sure. We're putting together the agenda now. It might possibly be the 3/16 or 1/4 bill or 4/16 or whatever you want to call it. So we're working that all out now, members. So with that, the meeting's adjourned, and we'll see you on Tuesday.